Ms. Gambino.
Good morning, Chief Judge Easterbrook, Judge Williams, and Judge Posner. We are here today because, on behalf of Will Carthen, to determine whether or not the district court had authority to reduce Mr. Carthen's sentence pursuant to 3582C. And it is our position that under the United States Supreme Court case of Freeman versus the United States, the district court did have the authority to reduce Mr. Carthen's sentence. The government suggests that this is not the case and that United States versus Ray should apply to the situation in Mr. Carthen's case. And it is our position that Mr. Carthen's case is...
The United States is relying most heavily on Dixon and Scott, which are post-Freeman cases. And you don't discuss either Dixon or Scott. Is there any way in which this situation can be distinguished from Dixon and Scott?
Well, the distinguishing factor in Mr. Carthen's case from Dixon and Scott, as well as Ray, is that you will not be contravening principles of contract interpretation in order to apply Freeman to Mr. Carthen's case. And the reason that that's so is that the intent of the parties in entering into the sentencing agreement in Mr. Carthen's case was to avoid the overly harsh consequences of applying the then mandatory sentencing guidelines.
Is this any different from Dixon or Scott?
Because Dixon and Scott did not involve the same kind of sentencing agreement, nor did Dixon and Scott occur at a time when the sentencing guidelines were in fact mandatory, and the court was faced with a choice between applying the mandatory guidelines or recognizing this sentencing agreement.
So then you're saying that in terms of contract law, you're drawing a distinction between a sentencing agreement and a plea agreement?
Yes, I am, and in this particular case, because we have to look toward, in any contract, the intent of the parties. And the reason for upholding a sentencing agreement or a plea agreement is the negotiated result of not wanting to disturb the outcome that's been negotiated by the parties. In this particular case, the important factor was not the particular sentence, but that the sentence not be a life sentence. And the effort was to avoid the overly harsh consequences of the operation of the law.
Well, isn't the new advisory guideline range life as well? So how can he benefit from the new guideline?
He could benefit from the new guideline because if you conducted a parallel analysis with what happened in the first case, the guideline range is reduced from a level 48 to a level 44. And if you, in the first case, there was an equivalent of a six-level reduction in the guideline range to arrive at the sentence that was ultimately imposed.
Counsel, I'm interested in Judge Williams's question, too. Her question didn't have to do with the levels. It had to do with the range, which appears to be life both before and after. The statute says unless the amendment changes the range, the district court can't resentence. So how did the range change?
While the ultimate range remains life, you also have to take into account the reduction of the under the terms of the agreement, which was six levels, and that would change the range significantly from a 44 to a 38.
It changes the number of offense levels, but I gather you agree that it doesn't change the range. And the statute says the judge can reduce the sentence if the range goes down, not if the offense level goes down. So how would the judge have any authority when the range didn't change?
Because I believe that you have to interpret it more broadly than the range as such when you're dealing with an agreement that involves a reduction of the range.
So then, but then the problem is there, you don't have a case that really says that.
That's
really
correct.
Really, did you sort of expand that language of the guidelines and that we're not stuck with that?
No, that's correct. I don't have a case that says that. In fact, I'm asking you to consider that, and particularly with respect to the case of Mr. Carthen, because Mr. Carthen is in the unfortunate position of having been sentenced in 2004 at a time when the guidelines were mandatory. As a part of that agreement, he had to agree not to appeal or raise a 2255, so he was not able to take advantage of the changes of the law which followed in Kimbrough and Booker, which, as his colleagues or co-defendants did, resulted in a far greater reduction in his sentence. And the law is supposed to be interpreted to further the purposes of the statute, in this case the FSA, to make sentencing more fair. And it's not to be interpreted to thwart the efforts to make those kinds of changes.
And then, so then how do you get around Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion that provides that sentences are only based on the guidelines and eligible for reductions in two narrow circumstances, neither of which is our situation?
Well, I think it takes basically an excessively narrow reading of what based on the guidelines means, because in this particular case, of course, the sentence was based on the guidelines. The judge had to determine what the guidelines were, had to take those into account in deciding whether or not to accept the agreement that was reached.
And that, to me, seems a very logical approach to this. But the Supreme Court didn't really buy that approach.
Well, one justice of the Supreme Court did not, and I understand that it's the lowest common denominator that prevails, but if you look at the other four justices, they certainly did not take such a narrow and crabbed reading of that particular provision. And there's a higher principle involved here, which is you're not – the courts, and particularly the district court, is not supposed to interpret the law to defeat the purpose of the statute. And that's precisely what's happening here. We're taking what was intended to be a contract to protect and save Mr. Carthen from the worst consequences of the law and turning it around and using as a cudgel to say, no, you can't benefit from any of the subsequent changes that happened in the law, and we're not going to allow you to benefit from the Fair Sentencing Act. And I think that in this particular case, such an unjust result is not warranted either by the law or by principles of contract law.
But if the range is lowered, how do you infer an intention that the defendant receive a more lenient sentence?
The range is lowered by the reduction that he received originally, which is why Freeman comes into play. The range itself, I understand the Judge Easterbrook's distinction between range and offense levels, but you also have to take into account the fact that when the credit is given as it originally was, the range is reduced to a much lower range than the one under which he was sentenced. If you have no further questions, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Sawyer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Catherine Sawyer on behalf of the United States. In this case, the district court correctly determined that it lacked the authority to reduce the defendant's sentence in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Freeman, and because even under the amended guidelines, defendant's sentencing range remained life imprisonment.
Well, what about her last argument? Why don't you begin there? You know, that, you know, because of the difference in the levels, it changed the range, and that might have had an impact.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, I think that both the policy statement in Section 1B1.10 and the case law interpreting both 3582 and that policy statement make clear that the inquiry is with respect to the guideline range. And what the defense would have this court do is essentially find that the value of that plea agreement was a six-level reduction in the sentencing guideline range, when that was in fact the practical effect of the agreement. A six-level reduction is not enshrined anywhere in the agreement itself, and on its face, the guideline range remains unchanged, and that is the central inquiry, both of the statute and of the applicable policy statement. And so I would assert that the court's inquiry can begin and end at that question.
So what about her argument that he's sort of caught in the switches in terms of where he was, you know, in terms of when he got sentenced and then all the subsequent changes, and everybody else was able to get advantage of it, but he cannot, sort of her equity or fairness argument. Fundamental fairness is, I guess, how I would characterize it, or she has.
Right, Your Honor. I would have to agree. He is obviously caught in an unenviable situation in terms of the timing, but the issue or the problem with that is that at the time that he was sentenced, at the time that he entered that sentencing agreement, he got a distinct benefit, which was an assurance that he would not be subject to a mandatory sentence of life in prison. His co-defendant took the risk that that sentence would stand and that he would be obligated to serve the entirety of that sentence. And so to take sort of retroactive look at that from where we sit now is not the inquiry that either the statute or the guidelines calls for. And while clearly I can't contest that were he sentenced under the existing regime, he would have gotten a lower sentence. But unfortunately, that's not the inquiry, and the equities simply don't come into play in the inquiry that the statute and that the guidelines call upon this court to make.
And then remind me, because I think I've just forgotten, what did the co-defendants get then on the reduction?
The defendant, Comey, was originally sentenced to 20 years, and then subsequently that sentence was reduced to 10 years. And so in response to the court's last question, the government acknowledges that this was a high sentence in this case, but it was a sentence that was agreed to by all parties in a written sentencing agreement in a case that did involve a four-year drug conspiracy of which this defendant was a leader, used a firearm to further that conspiracy, and employed a minor under 18 to commit that offense and obstructed justice by suborning perjury at his criminal trial. The agreement he entered into was a trade-off which protected him at the time from a mandatory life sentence. And for all of those reasons, if the court has no further questions, the government would respectfully request that this court affirm the ruling of the district court, which correctly determined that it lacked authority to provide relief to the defendant under 3582C2. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Gambino?
Three issues. First of all, the last point first with regard to the court.
If a defendant starts off with very, very high levels, right, then it's entirely possible that a sentencing amendment that reduces, that knocks off a couple of levels, will still leave him with an unaltered sentencing range, right?
That's possible, yes.
So isn't that this case?
No, that's not this case.
If he'd started off with a lower level, lower base offense level, then he would have benefited from the amendment, right? It's just that he started so high.
He did start high, but he also entered into this agreement, and part of the agreement was recognition for cooperation, for which he received a six-level reduction. And you can't ignore the fact, even though it's not explicitly written out, that we start, the guidelines are explicitly written out in the agreement. The ultimate sentence is written out in the agreement. And so by deduction, the guideline range was reduced. You can't ignore that simply because it's not written out word by word. And had this case been negotiated post-Freeman, certainly these cases from now on will be written out word by word when that's the intent. But in 2004, none of this was predictable. And what we have left with is a disparity, an unwarranted disparity between co-defendants. Because while the government points out...
He started with a with an offense level of 48, right?
That's correct. After the...
Well, what if the sentencing amendment had reduced it to 47?
If he had still received the reduction as he did, my argument would be the same, that there was a reduction in levels, and as a result of his cooperation...
So you're saying a reduction in level always has to reduce sentence?
No, it doesn't always have to, but in this case it did, because we can't ignore the fact that he received a significant reduction in range, which would be entitled to carry over under Freeman. So this isn't the sort of case, it's a unique case. It's not the kind of case that's going to apply to every other defendant who comes before the court with a change in a, with no change in range, with no subsequent reduction. And in this particular case, the government suggests that Mr. Coney, the co-defendant, took the risk of sitting with his sentence while Mr. Carthen did not. And the appropriate...
Thank you, Ms. Gambino.
Thank you, Judge.
We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case.
And we ask that the case be reversed.
The case is taken under advisement.